are Radio Catskill.
Live from the Radio Catskill studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Sullivan County is putting $2 million on the table to tackle the affordable housing crisis. But how far will it go, and who will benefit? Talking with Isabel Braverman, the editor of the Sullivan County Democrat, about what this means for renters, landlords, and the future of housing in our region. A new roadside art installation is turning heads and sparking conversations about public art in New Paltz at Water Street Market. We'll learn more. There's an immersive and creative new shadow puppet performance at NACL this weekend. And what happens when classic films meet live dance, music, and mime? The Vannevar Caravan's A Night at the Movies brings the big screen to life on stage. That's all coming up. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Texas Republican Attorney General Ken Paxton says he'll go to court to have Democratic lawmakers who fled the state thrown out of office. The Texas Democrats are blocking all work in the state house because they're not there. Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider reports the Democrats oppose a Republican plan to redraw Texas congressional districts.
For the second time this week, the Texas House failed to have a quorum. Attorney General Paxton said he would wait until Friday, then go to court to have the offices of any Democrats who have fled the state declared abandoned. He's argued that would let Governor Greg Abbott name their replacements. Charles Rocky Rhodes, a constitutional law professor at the University of Missouri Law School, says it's not that simple.
If you think about the idea of separation of powers, you can see why he doesn't have that authority. We don't want the governor to be able to handpick members of the legislature.
Rhodes says it's uncertain that a court would declare the offices abandoned, and the most Governor Abbott could do is call for new elections. For NPR News, I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
Democratic leaders in other states are watching developments in Texas. California Governor Gavin Newsom and New York Governor Kathy Hochul say they will consider similar redistricting in their states to benefit Democrats if the Texas GOP plan succeeds. The Israeli Security Cabinet is scheduled to meet tomorrow on the country's next steps in the war in Gaza. This comes as some Republican lawmakers have started to question U.S. support for Israel over starvation in Gaza. NPR's Franco Ordonez says President Trump has used caution.
We've been seeing him tread very carefully here. I mean, for example, after Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said there was no starvation in Gaza, Trump notably broke with the prime minister and said there clearly was. But Trump has stopped short of directly criticizing Israel for blocking aid shipments and instead focused on blaming Hamas for stealing aid.
NPR's Franco Ordonez reporting. Stocks opened mixed this morning on Wall Street as both Disney and McDonald's reported encouraging financial results. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped more than 10 points in early trading.
More people are visiting Disney theme parks, and more international customers are signing up for the Disney Plus streaming service. That helped the entertainment giant post better-than-expected profits for the most recent quarter. Meanwhile, Disney's ESPN network has struck a tentative deal to acquire the NFL network and distribute the Red Zone channel. In exchange, the National Football League would receive a 10% stake in ESPN. McDonald's delivered a happy meal to its investors with a nearly 4% jump in sales at existing restaurants during the quarter. A promotional tie-in with the Minecraft movie, as well as new McCrispy chicken strips, helped draw customers to McDonald's at a time when some rival fast food chains are struggling. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR. President Trump's 50% tariffs against Brazil have gone into effect. These tariffs could affect many goods Americans want, such as coffee and beef. Trump says his tariffs are over Brazil's prosecution of his ally, former far-right Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro. Bolsonaro will soon go on trial for trying to overturn his election loss in 2022. President Trump's special envoy has completed a meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Steve Witkoff is at the Kremlin days before a deadline set by Trump. Trump says if Russia does not end its war in Ukraine, he will impose significant new penalties on Russia. A New York startup has become the first company to publicly acknowledge plans to pursue the creation of gene-edited babies. NPR's Rob Stein has more.
The company, which is opening a lab in New York City, is called the Manhattan Project. The company plans to demonstrate that it would be safe to use the latest gene editing technologies to modify the DNA in human embryos. The goal is to prevent inherited diseases. The announcement comes amid a flurry of interest in trying to commercialize gene-edited human embryos, which has long been considered taboo. Proponents say modifying human embryos could alleviate a lot of suffering. Critics say it's dangerous and unethical and could lead to designer babies. Rob Stein, NPR News.
Tennessee Republican Senator Marsha Blackburn has announced she will run for the office of Tennessee governor. She'll join the GOP primary, and she'll face Tennessee Congressman John Rose next year. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Today, we're taking a closer look at a big move by the Sullivan County Legislature to address what leaders are calling a full-blown housing crisis. Last month, lawmakers approved $2 million in grant funding to kickstart two new programs aimed at creating and improving affordable rental housing across the county. It's money that could help both landlords and developers, but there still are a lot of questions about how it will work and who it will help. Joining us now is Isabel Braverman, editor of the Sullivan County Democrat, and they've got new coverage about this issue out now. Isabel, welcome.
Hi.
Let's start with the basics. What exactly did the county legislature vote on when it comes to this housing crisis?
Sure. So they approved $2 million in funding for a rental housing program in Sullivan County. The money will fuel two programs, the Rental Rehabilitation Program and the Rental Construction Program.
Okay, and this is a big step to tackle the housing crisis in Sullivan County. How bad is the situation right now?
So, yeah, according to some of the legislators, there is a housing crisis right now. And actually, new data just came out from Hudson Valley Pattern for Progress, and it showed that since 2019, there has been a 121% increase in home prices. So, you know, pre-COVID years, they've jumped 121% since then. And on top of that, there is a low stock of housing available. And also many rental houses are dilapidated and in need of upgrading and repairs.
And where is this $2 million coming from, and how is it going to be used?
So it was set aside in the 2025 budget that the Sullivan County Legislature has already approved. So they're looking at the $2 million as a first step to get these two housing programs started and off the ground.
And what, sorry, but the issue that we're facing, as you said, these increases in costs and the lack of housing stock, really impacting the area. And there are two new programs mentioned in the article. Can you break those down for us in sort of more, you know, simple terms?
Sure. So the Rental Rehabilitation Program is for families who would be considered, you know, low-income households. So that's at or below 80% of the median household income. And then the rehabilitation program would be to improve existing structures. And then the other program is the new rental construction program, and that would be working with developers to create new housing that they would want to be considered affordable housing.
And who are these programs really meant to help? Are we talking about renters, landlords, developers, or, you know, all of the above?
Yeah, it's sort of an all-of-the-above situation. It will help renters in terms of offering better housing and new housing for those who are low-income. But it will also help developers with the new construction program, because the county will be working with the developers to create new housing, and some funding will be available for that.
And when we talk about affordable housing, can you tell us, like, what does that actually mean in Sullivan County right now? What is considered affordable?
So according to data from 2023, the current median household income in Sullivan County is around $69,000, $69,826. So in terms of these programs, it would target families, one would be at or below 80% of the median household income, and the other one would be at 60% of household income. So I think, affordable housing would be meeting those thresholds, and also not exceeding 30% of the household's annual income. So it has to meet those numbers.
I noticed in your story in the Sullivan County Democrat that some legislators weren't totally on board. What were their concerns?
Right. So they were concerned with this $2 million that will start the program. Their concern was how would that be replenished? So once the $2 million is used, where would money come from to continue these programs?
And so the thing that keeps coming up is the idea of a lack of affordable housing with this plan or this plan to kickstart plans. Is this something that's going to keep going on year after year, or is it more of a one-time shot?
I think for right now, it's a one-time thing. They didn't really discuss plans for the future. However, some of the legislators who were in favor of this said that it's a good, it's just a first step to get the ball rolling.
You covered some pretty specific rules landlords and developers have to follow in the article in the Democrat, like keeping rent affordable for years. Do you think that'll work in practice?
That's a good question. I think that, these programs seem to be set up in a way that we'll really make sure those numbers are followed. So, yes, I think in practice that it could work.
And do we think this move is enough to make a dent in the crisis? We mentioned the home prices going up 120% since 2019. Do we think that this investment is going to, really do something?
Yeah, I think it's, maybe hard to say at this point because, some of the legislators were saying $2 million is not really enough to tackle this crisis. However, others were saying that it's just the first step in the right direction. And I think that once they get these programs started and see how many people sign up to be a part of it, that really could get the ball rolling and further the programs and, possibly allocate more funding for them.
Start of a long process here, but at least a start. It's Isabel right. Braverman, editor of the Sullivan County Democrat. You can read this story and other stories in the Democrat at scdemocratonline.com or out on the newsstands like we used to do. It's Isabel Braverman. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll take a quick break. And when we come back, how the Trump administration's policies are impacting Hudson Valley farms. We'll learn more from the New York Public News Network after this. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
Hi, Ira Flatow here from Science Friday. We view Sci-Fry as a refreshing break from the daily bombardment of political news. You know, there's lots of important and interesting science and technology out there. Whether it's the deep, dark mysteries of the universe or your deep, dark microbiome, it's all right here. So start your weekends with thought-provoking news on Radio Catskill.
Next time on the Retro Cocktail Hour, Dick Shorey's Percussion Pops plays Duke Ellington, Ferrante and Teicher Go Hawaiian, and Martin Denny plays Les Baxter. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Join me where the music's always shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour. Coming up tonight at 7 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Congressman Pat Ryan was in Orange County Tuesday to highlight how the Trump administration's policies are impacting Hudson Valley farms. From the New York Public News Network, WAMC Hudson Valley Bureau Chief Jesse King reports.
So these are the
pink ladies.
Yeah. All right, perfect.
Ryan, a Democrat from the 18th District, stopped by Crist Brothers Orchards in Walden to try out some apples and ask farmers how they're doing. Fifth-generation farmer Jeff Crist has expanded Crist Brothers Orchards significantly over his tenure. The orchard now produces roughly 500,000 bushels of apples each year. But he's got his eye on how the president's tariffs may impact his ability to buy equipment and export apples overseas.
We estimate between August 1st, which was last week, through the end of the year, tariffs we pay on different pieces of equipment will cost us about $60,000 on our farm.
It's not just tariffs. Ryan says he's heard from Hudson Valley farmers who worry they will lose their Medicaid coverage as a result of new work requirements in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. Others say their staffing is at risk from federal efforts to ramp up deportations. And Ryan says agricultural scientists and food banks are reeling from funding cuts at the USDA.
The cuts to federal funding for research and development in ag and farming, to me, are extremely concerning because this makes us just less competitive, both immediately and in the medium and long term, as a country and specifically as a region in the Hudson Valley.
Crist says agricultural research by schools like Cornell University has been instrumental in his farm's success. For starters, Crist Brothers Orchards bought the intellectual property rights to two apple breeds created by Cornell University's breeding program, the Snapdragon and Ruby Frost. He says Cornell scientists visit the farm multiple times a year and taught them how to mitigate pests and prune trees in a way that helps each apple receive better sunlight. Just in the past couple of years, Crist says the farm has refined how it stores its crops and now has the technology to store apples in a way that keeps them fresh for up to 12 months, meaning grocers who want Fuji apples year-round can, in fact, buy them from Crist Brothers Orchards.
The growing and the technology and science we use literally changes every year to improve what we do to be able to store apples for 12 months. We were never able to do that before. So it's over a period of time, it's a huge impact to keep us competitive in the world.
Crist says his orchard ships thousands of pounds of apples to the Regional Food Bank of Northeastern New York each month. But that number may differ amid cuts to the USDA's Emergency Food Assistance Program, or TFAP. Earlier this year, the USDA announced it was cutting roughly $1 billion from two programs, including TFAP, that source local produce for food banks. Ryan says he's hopeful that some of that funding may be restored, even if not fully. The same can't be said for SNAP, which took a big hit in the Big Beautiful Bill. Lucy Joyce, executive director of the Cornell Cooperative Extension in Orange County, says the law also gutted funding for SNAP's educational grant program, SNAP Ed. SNAP Ed funds programs in schools and community organizations that teach low-income residents how to make the most of their food budgets, including making healthier food choices and becoming more physically active. Joyce says CCE Orange County is one of the lead agencies implementing these programs, holding more than 900 classes across the Hudson Valley last year. But as a result of the cuts, it will effectively end on September 30th. Joyce says 11 staff members will lose their jobs.
At this time, it looks like New York State has some funding in their coffers through this programming. With that funding, we're looking for guidance to be able to wind it down in a more professional manner, where it won't be such an abrupt end.
During his visit, Ryan touted his support for bills like the Dignity Act, which he says would create a better pathway for citizenship for immigrants who make up a large share of the nation's agricultural workforce. He points to the partial return of TFAP funding as an example of what residents can accomplish when they speak out.
To be specific and local, sharing these stories is actually really powerful.
Reporting from Walden for WAMC's Hudson Valley Bureau on the campus of Vassar College, I'm Jesse King.
And an update on the weather for you. New York State officials expect poor air quality linked to distant Canadian wildfires to impact the state throughout the week. State Department of Environmental Conservation Commissioner Amanda Lefton spoke during a virtual press conference on Tuesday.
We expect to continue to see poor air quality in much of the state.
At least until Thursday, we might see some clearing up happening then. However, we continue to make sure that we are keeping a very close and watchful eye on the forecast, both for the weather as well as how the smoke is moving in and potentially impacting the air quality across the state.
Officials are asking residents to take precautions as hazy, smoky air continues to blanket the state, including by limiting prolonged or strenuous outdoor activity. State Health Commissioner James McDonald says pollution caused by fine particulate matter can cause health problems for sensitive groups.
Because these particles are very small, they can travel deep into our lungs, and it could cause an irritation. Sometimes it'll affect people with asthma, or even people with other lung diseases, or people with heart disease. Other people that are at risk are people who are older than 65 or someone who's pregnant.
And a reminder that air quality advisory remains in effect for the region. We'll take a break, and when we come back, a new public art installation, We Are Public Health, blending a powerful message about public health and who it's really for. We'll learn more after a break. It's Radio Chatskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFRadio.org.
The White House asked Congress to pull back federal funding for public media that had already been approved, and Congress has gone along. We want you to know that NPR and this station remain committed to informing the public, increasing your understanding of the world, and hopefully enriching your life in other ways. But without federal funding, we're relying on your support now more than ever. Please make your gift to this station today. Here's how.
Give now at WJFFradio.org. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. A new roadside art installation is turning heads and sparking conversations about public art in New Paltz at Water Street Market. It's all part of a collaboration between local artist Ryan Cronin and the Ulster County Department of Health. The campaign, called We Are Public Health, blends visuals with a powerful message about reimagining what public health looks like and who it's really for. Radio Catskill's Jamie Case takes us there to speak with artist Ryan Cronin, Melanie Cronin of the Cronin Gallery, and Ulster County Deputy Health Commissioner Mary Jane Shepherd.
If you've ever walked down a street in New Paltz, New York, you might have noticed a couple of peculiar lawn signs. More specifically, a sign with two half-human, half-bunny-looking figures crossing a street. This type of public and thought-provoking art is exactly what Ryan Cronin has become known for, and is what the director of the Ulster County Department of Health wanted to use as their iconography for the We Are Public Health campaign.
Well, she actually approached me first and asked if it would be a project that Ryan would consider. It was an idea she had, a phrase. We Are Public Health was a phrase. It started one way, and then when she first approached, and I thought, this seems like right up Ryan's alley. So I went home and ran the idea by him, and he was instantly a yes.
As an artist with a mission to make art accessible to all, the collaboration felt natural to Ryan.
Lawn signs have always been something that kind of interests me, and in how people take interest in actually really creating almost works of art that sit on the side of the road temporarily. So it comes pretty natural for me to kind of focus on, have a topic, and then develop iconography that sort of speaks the language of that topic, whether it's like in physical text or icons, or the mixture of both, to produce a piece. Because I think my work in general doesn't take a whole lot. You know, you don't have to spend hours looking at it. It's pretty immediate. You know, you walk, you see it, whether it's on a museum or gallery wall or in the public space. It's almost immediate. You can kind of like read it pretty quickly and move on. And that's where that influence from like billboards and street signs and WPA posters plays a role in how I'm working today. So to me, it's pretty natural to work in that realm as far as, you know, bringing awareness to certain subjects.
And work naturally in the realm of public advocacy, Cronin does. Having completed the painting based off of the phrase, "We are public health," the next step of the campaign is creating 100-plus lawn signs that will sit adjacent to public health facilities in Ulster County.
As an example, maybe in front of a camp for children, because the camp has to be inspected, and in front of a restaurant, in front of a water treatment facility, all the different spots where public or public health takes place, basically, where the Department of Health has Yeah, plays a role. Thank you. With that in mind and understanding Ryan's ability to be effective using his work as messaging, I think that was kind of the start of it. And the idea of using a QR code on it, you know, gives people quick access. I know it's their mission at the Department of Health to use this as a way to really activate dialogue on what it means, the Department of Health, what they do, and what their mission is. And that was a big point of, you know, kind of weaving all of this together, from Ryan being inspired by signs on the side of the road when he first came, you know, to college in New Paltz back in the day. And now it's like kind of just part of this bigger campaign that happens. It's happening organically.
And for the Cronins, community building is more than just a campaign aesthetic. It's a key component to the way that they run their lives and their gallery in New Paltz. When I went to see the paintings that will serve as a basis for the lawn signs, I came into contact with Mary Jane Shepherd, who was actually the Cronin Gallery's first guest exhibition. Her piece was unveiled in the gallery right next to the We Are Public Health campaign paintings. And when I spoke to her, we actually found a huge commonality between the meaning of the two pieces.
Sanctuary is very much about community, and so many people came and helped and poured paper pulp with me and embedded strings along with their intentions and hopes for the future. And a big part of it is looking to the past at what worked and what didn't. It's clear that our well-being is wrapped up in each other. It's not just about our own needs, it's about the community, it's about the planet. My husband just read to me the other day this quote by Wendell Berry about that doing what's good for ourselves is not necessarily good for the world, but if we do things that are good for the world, it will automatically be good for us. And it's really important that we pay attention to that right now.
Part of what makes this campaign so effective is the seamless symbiotic relationship between a governmental body and an artist, which some might consider long opposing forces. But according to Melanie, Ryan's art has never been made without a message.
It's always been something he has done. So, like, you know, we've been together since college, right? And I remember literally hanging off the side of a bridge as he's chaining a piece of art to it. It's like it's always been there from when he was back in a band and making stickers, or we're hanging work off of bridges, and then that goes back to the influence of that hand-lettered sign on the side of the road. And it, so it's weaving together. And then we've done a lot of work around women's health and awareness for HPV. And so this was a project he worked on with a doctor called The Box. And so it's like he's been out in public his entire career, even though he makes paintings and we sell them for your wall. So it's been there the whole time. It's a thread.
You know, you reach a larger audience when your work's out in the public realm, and you're reaching, you know, not necessarily the traditional art audience that, you know, and everybody takes a little bit of something away from it, you know, whether it's the intended response or not. It stops people for a second. They look. They might think, they may not think.
We hope they think.
Yeah, take something away, you know, quickly. So
now that the paintings for the We Are Public Health campaign have been unveiled, the lawn signs are underway, and MJ's sanctuary piece has been displayed, you would think that the Cronins might take a little bit of a break. but actually they're more than ready for the next thing.
And for us as a business, it's cool because once she takes it down, then we are going to look at our four walls as a blank slate. Now, again, we're going to, on Monday and Tuesday, Wednesday, we're going to just get in here together and reimagine the space. So that's been a fun part of the overall experience too.
In New Paltz, public art isn't confined to galleries. It's on your morning walk. It's a conversation with a neighbor. It's a sign that somebody's paying attention.
And, you know, to me, the real significance is when the Department of Health, specifically Eve, she came to us and was like, you know, they asked an artist and not like a graphic designer or marketing corporation or, you know, or company or, you know, that to me says a lot about how they value arts in this community. So I was honored to be asked and super grateful to be a part.
For more, you can check out Ryan's other campaigns like Expect a Bike or Expect a Pedestrian, or the upcoming Fourth Friday events at the Cronin Gallery and Water Street Market in New Paltz, New York. For Radio Catskill, I'm Jamie Case.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, the Silver Screen gets a live twist at the Rosendale Theater. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. This week, it may be too hot to even think about turning on your oven, but we're going to do our best to make you want to. We've got summer baking with the Pie Queen of Los Angeles and a 60-time Blue Ribbon winner at the Iowa State Fair. It's coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11, on Radio Catskill.
Forget text messages. Catherine Kuchenbecker is developing tech to reach out and touch you.
You could send not just a little buzz, but like a pat or eventually a caress or a congratulatory one, a high five that comes in over your chat.
Ideas about our skin and how we interact with the world. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Friday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Vannevar Caravan's Summer Dance Intensive students are bringing movie magic to the stage at the Rosendale Theater this Friday in A Night at the Movies, a variety show packed with music, dance, mime, and film, from classic cinema moments to contemporary favorites, the showcase reimagines iconic film scenes. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi spoke with Miranda Way, executive director of the Vannevar Caravan, to share what audiences can expect.
Welcome to Radio Chatskill, Miranda Way. You are the executive director of Vannevar Caravan.
Yeah, we're a Hudson Valley dance and music company with some international touring. And we've been around the region for a really long time.
You're having a wonderful event coming up on the 8th of August at 6 p.m. That's a Friday. It will be at the Rosendale Theater. And it is A Night at the Movies, a variety show in live dance and music. And that sounds like a lot of fun. But before we get to that, I'd like to share with our audience the origins of Vannevar Caravan.
So Bill and Livia Vannevar founded the Vannevar Caravan in 1972, so over half a century ago. And Bill was a musician, and Livia is a dancer choreographer. And the two of them met and fell in love also with their love of the arts together. And they traveled the world learning dances and music from people in every walk of life. And we are so fortunate that they decided to settle down in the Hudson Valley over 30 years ago. They set their roots here, and I started dancing with them when I was 4 years old, and many, many generations of people have continued dancing in the Hudson Valley. We have a pretty ingrained and beloved dance community.
Well, that's here. Quite a tribute to the founders.
Yes, and Bill Vannevar did pass just just about 2 months ago. Yes, so we've been mourning that loss and celebrating his life and legacy and holding space for him all summer in music and dance. So,
well, continuing his legacy is the important thing.
Yeah, exactly.
And what is the mission?
The mission of the Vannevar Caravan is to inspire in others a love for dance and music and to celebrate our humanity together. We envision a world that is not divided, but that celebrates the diversity of cultures throughout the world. And really, I mean, this is veering off of the mission slightly, but we really, really know that the arts can be such a catalyst for social change and for compassion and empathy and community connection. And so that's really what we're all about.
I read that you have a caravan in India.
We do, yeah. And we actually have an exchange student right now at Summer Dance, Shruti. She is dancing with us. And we have been going to India since 2012 to both Udaipur, which is in the state of Rajasthan, and also down to Tamil Nadu in Pondicherry. We've been going to Auroville, and we teach in the schools there, and we perform, and we've been doing just a over decade-long cultural exchange with them, so with our friends in India.
And where in the Hudson Valley do you perform aside from Rosendale?
Great question. We will be at UPAC in Kingston celebrating Bill Vannevar's Life and Legacy, a tribute concert in September, on September 14th. We will be back at Rosendale Theater. Actually, again, we love our home theater in December. We have a few shows and performances coming up, mainly actually in Kingston. We also do tons of arts education programming. So we perform at the Pete and Toshi Seeger Theater in the spring for Calico Ball, and that's with the entire Beacon City School District. Same with Rondout City School District. So we do a lot of arts education performances as well. We're always happy to perform anywhere people will have us.
And you're in demand, I see.
yeah, I'd say we are.
Let's talk a little bit about the variety show.
Yes. So Brian Lawton, who is our associate artistic director, has been coming for the past few years to our Summer Dance Intensive, which takes place at Lifebridge Sanctuary in Rosendale. If you don't know about Lifebridge, it is gorgeous. It is an incredible space, and we are so lucky to be there. And we have 2 weeks of intensive dance training, which is going on right now, even in the heat. And Brian comes in and directs and sort of looks at all the different styles of dance, whether it be modern dance, ballet, Bollywood, Afro-Caribbean soca, Lindy Hop, Appalachian clogging, house dance, hip hop. And then we have also theater and physical comedy. And he kind of assembles all the different styles and puts together a performance in just these 2 weeks. And this year, I don't want to give away too much, but I can tell you that we are leaning into the fact that it's at the Rosendale Movie Theater, and we'll be doing little vignettes in film as well as in live dance and music. So it's a variety show. It travels through time, and it travels this year through genres. So we're very excited about that genre. So there will be anything from horror to film noir to action adventure to romance. We're doing all sorts of different vignettes. So what's very cool about these 2 weeks is that the faculty and the students come into them with a little bit of a blank slate. We have kind of our theme and our concept, but then they all help to create the show that is at the end of the 2 weeks. And that's a pretty cool thing. And I should just shout out our incredible faculty. We've got Charlotte Strickles on modern dance, Nina Yerka on ballet, Rafael Pustelny on Lindy Hop, Bollywood with Krupa Garash, Soca, Afro-Caribbean Soca with Ariana Brisport, house dance with Gabriel Vannevar, Appalachian clogging with Livia Vannevar, and then we have theater and physical comedy with Broadway's Herman Shebeck. There will be other guest people jumping in and out, but those are our main faculty. And it's just such an incredible team. It feels so good to be in that space together.
Well, listening to you, you've made me smile because it sounds like so much fun. And I feel excited for the performers being a part of this.
Yeah, yeah. We have a lot of fun over there. It's a really good time. And we really try to emphasize the heart of it all, right? That it's not a competitive dance program. It's a really immersive and collaborative and community-oriented experience that the children get, you know, almost a year's worth of dance training in these 2 weeks. They're dancing 6 hours a day. But it's really, really focused around the feeling of safety and community.
And what are the age ranges?
The age range is 9 to 18, and we also have some over 18 counselors in training that are there taking the programming and also modeling. 9 to 18 and all the way to 74.
Wow. Well, that is inclusive. And you are inclusive with dance styles as well. So this sounds like a really fabulous event coming up Friday, August 8th at 6 p.m. in Rosendale. Anything else you'd like to add?
I mean, you got it covered. We're so happy to be at the Rosendale Theater. We're so happy to be at LifeBridge. Our home base in Rosendale has been really lovely. Admission for this program, we are trying to make all of our programming as accessible as possible. So it's on a pay what you can sliding scale with the suggested donation of $15. And you can get your tickets on the Vannevar Caravan website.
And what is that website?
www.vannevar, V-A-N-A-V-E-R, caravan, caravan.org.
Okay. Well, thank you again, Miranda.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks to culture reporter Valerie Manzi for that report. We'll take a quick break. And when we come back, this Saturday, NACL Theater in Highland Lake showcasing a new performance. We'll learn more about that with its co-composer and writer and the NACL's Brett Kaiser. This is Radio Chatskill.
On the next Radio Lab,
you see these wasps?
Editor Alex Neeson slogs through dusty archives and swampy cemeteries.
Ooh, I'm stepping in mud.
To uncover,
where are you?
The dark history behind her name.
This is where it starts.
And figure out if your name is something you have to move past or...
Wait! What?
If it's your best way of moving forward.
You know, I'm right here. I'm moving forward.
That's on the next Radio Lab. This afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
When you walk into NPR headquarters, one of the first things you see is a big map of the country covered with little blue dots. Each dot represents a local public radio station. That's the NPR network. I'm Catherine Marr, CEO of NPR. With federal funding for public media eliminated, your network is under serious threat. Help us plan for the road ahead by giving to this station today. Thank you.
Give now at wjffradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. NACL Theater in Highland Lake is showcasing a haunting and imaginative new shadow puppet performance this Saturday, created by composer and writer Rima Fand in collaboration with puppet designer Aaron Orr. It's called A Fishing Line Sings. Drawing on childhood memories, ancient myths, and even evolutionary science, the piece explores fishing as a metaphor for memory, longing, and loss, with a line cast into the unknown to connect us to what's disappeared. Joining us now to talk about this deeply personal and visually rich performance are co-creator Rima Fand and NACL's Brett Kaiser. Welcome.
Thanks, Tim.
Thanks for having us.
Rima, how did I do with that? Did I get that okay? Is that sort of what it's like? Tell people what inspired this. What memory or spark led you to create A Fishing Line Sings?
Yeah. So I just felt like I wanted to make something out of my first memory in life, which was at age 3 fishing on Lake George with my father. And that was a very special place. We went to the Adirondacks. We went specifically to Lake George every summer, and it was a really special place for my family. And the more I thought about this memory, I became interested in the idea of fishing as a metaphor for remembering, kind of like pulling things from the deep, bringing them back. And then at the same time, I became really fascinated by mythologies of women who transform into fish and sort of in order to escape into other realms. And, you know, mythologies of fishermen who are trying to retrieve that that woman that got away. And then it kind of dawned on me that I was actually trying to connect with my mother after she passed away as a fish through this fishing line. But it's also, so I imagine there's this song of, you know, my mother fish who's out there that's kind of, and I'm trying to connect with it through a fishing line that it's kind of like vibrating like a musical string. But then I also thought about the idea that we are kind of evolved from fish, that we are fish that kind of like walked onto land at a certain point. And so it's also kind of the song of the ancestor fish and trying to find this ancient song that's vibrating, always vibrating down there, but we're connecting to it through a fishing line.
You have all these different layers of this and, you know, memory and loss, the poetry of that, the personal connection, the, I guess, is this a memorial tribute in some ways? Do you think
it
when
is
you mentioned
some,
your
yeah,
mom and the,
yeah.
this, you also said the people have disappeared into
yeah,
the deep?
Yeah. But I felt like, yeah, it's maybe, hopefully, can be a universe. It's very personal. It's definitely the most personal piece that I've ever created, but I hope that it might, you know, resonate, you know, for others who are, feel like they're kind of reaching into another realm to connect with people that they may have lost or, you know, wondering where they are and how to communicate with them still.
Yeah.
You know,
you're blending these personal memories with myth and then even there's science as well. How do these things sort of intertwine for you in this writing process?
Yeah. Interestingly, my father, who is a big part of this piece too, he is a biologist.
Okay.
and I interviewed him about many things, including, you know, the memories of Lake George for him and my mother kind of swimming around like a mermaid and his own memories of fishing with his own father. And I also interviewed him about, you know, kind of, the way he saw the evolution, you know, and describing the various phases of us, you know, starting as invertebrates and then making our way into having a strong fin, which helped push us out of the water. And then, you know, this idea of, you know, in some ways, like we go through like a mini evolution even in the womb. So it's like, you know, this, yeah.
I mentioned, of course, this is a shadow puppet theater. You collaborated with Aaron Orr. And how did that collaboration and puppet direction come together and that design as well bring all of this to life?
Yeah. So Aaron Orr is a very dear and wonderful collaborator. I've worked with her for, I think, 20 years now. And this is kind of like what we do. I bring the music. She brings the visuals and we make this sort of poetry that is visual and musical. And we've made several shows together. And when I was dreaming up this show, I just thought Aaron is going to be the one who's going to be able to bring these images that I have in my mind to life and add her own layers of richness. She always does. There's always like there's a certain narration that I bring to it, a certain storytelling, but then she always has other images that are evoked by the story that are not the story itself, but other evocations. So it expands with the images that she brings, and so it seemed like a good fit.
True to the tradition of NACL, this is a work in progress.
Right.
How long have you been working on this with Aaron?
Well, we started working on it over 10 years ago.
Oh, wow.
And put together a very short excerpt we presented in a Puppets and Poets festival, just like 10 minutes. And then I had to put it aside for personal reasons because my father passed away.
Oh,
and I realized like it doesn't feel joyful to work on this piece right now. But recently it started to feel celebratory again. It started to feel like something that would feel good.
I didn't know that about your father, and I'm sorry for your loss there. But when you mentioned your father as a biologist, you smiled and lit up. And so it feels like this celebratory part is coming back to you in this process.
It is, yeah. To feel so close to my parents and to their memories and their stories. It feels like a happy thing to work on again. So,
Brett, talk a little bit more about, and we talked about this before with you, at an ACL, you provide this space for artists to bring work to create. Talk a little bit about this work in particular and seeing some of its development so far.
Well, the interesting thing is, and I was about to ask Rima a question about it, is that when the artists come, often they go into the space and are working there through the week, and we don't always know what's happening. And so we are sometimes in the same position as the audience when we do the public presentation of seeing it for the first time with the audience. So I actually don't, I mean,
Is that the case here?
That is the case here. Yeah. I haven't seen any or heard anything that they're working on. I have had the pleasure of working with Rima in the past. She's been to NACL numerous times. The last being for the production of Courage, that was, we were trying to recall, I think it was 2015, at Apple Pond Farm, and then there was a subsequent performances at Governor's Island in the city. So I know that we are in for a treat. I just don't know what that
And just to explain, that's not because you're not showing up for work. It's that you are giving the artists their space.
Exactly.
Why is it important for you to share this as a work in progress instead of, you know, it being, quote, complete, Rima?
Yeah, well, it's just where we're at in our process. We have, you know, we have certain parts of the script that are fleshed out more, and certain parts that we have ideas about, but we haven't actually made the things. Like, that's the thing with puppetry is, you know, you create these ideas of images, and then, but there's a lot, there's a long, there's a, you know, time consuming process to actually create those images. It's like, may you make a little mock-up version of the puppet first, and then you play with it and say, oh, it needs to be modified in this way, right? And that, you know, so there's a process of discovering, like, how to actually, you know, manifest the images in the way you intend, and you make discoveries.
Are there surprises or challenges in these discoveries that you've come across in
development all the time.
Can you share some of those?
I mean you make a puppet that seems like it's just perfect, and then you start moving it around and you're like, oh, it actually doesn't do what we need it to do. You know, the objects have very, like, specific functions, you know. So yes, there's been making and remaking already in the past couple days.
You mentioned human fish transformation earlier.
Yeah.
This is actually rooted in some Slavic and Finnish folklore and myths. What drew you to that mythology in particular?
Yeah. I actually had the opportunity to tour around Finland with a wonderful puppeteer there. I was making music for her puppet show, and I became really interested in the Finnish mythology. And I discovered, you know, this myth of Vanhemoinen, who's kind of like one of the primordial deities of the Finnish pantheon. And he has a young woman, Aino, who he loves and wants to be his wife. And she says, you know, I would rather live with the fishes than be an old man's wife. And so she transforms into a fish, and she escapes him, and he goes out fishing for her. And actually catches her as a fish, doesn't realize that he has caught her. And she tells him, you foolish Vanhemoinen, and now you've lost me for good. But there was, I felt in the longing for the, you know, of Vanhemoinen, I sort of felt the longing myself of, like, the one who got away, and how can we bring this loved one back to us on the fishing line?
How do you hope or imagine folks will connect with this blend of the fantastical and the deeply personal?
Yeah, I think the fantastical is what makes it fun. there's some, you know, in that Vanhemoinen story, and even in our evolution story, there's definitely some really lighthearted, very magical, fun moments. And I just think, you know, shadow puppetry is such a magical form in and of itself. Like, you really can be transported into, you know, we're doing things with, you know, scale, where, like, you're seeing something from afar, but then suddenly you're zooming in on the fish hook that's beneath the water, and, you know, kind of just diving into this world of mystery. and imagining what might be down there.
Do you look for audience feedback in a work in progress like this?
Absolutely. And I feel like one of the, you know, I mean, there's so many wonderful benefits to this week that we're having, just having space in a theater. This is something very hard to come by in New York City. Mm-hmm. We're trying to, like, you know, approximate things in our basements, but we don't actually have the space to really explore. So having that space, having a wonderful home in which we are taken, you know, we are nourished so well. But having an audience to take in what we're presenting and to be able to give feedback. And I've been in this audience before and I know how attuned they are, how, you know, how invested they are. And the feedback is just priceless. So yeah, for us to be kind of in the midst of our process and to hear, you know, what's resonating, what's unclear, you know, what they want to know more about, what questions they have is really, really deeply valuable.
And Brett, you're not only giving the artists their space and nourishment, you're giving the audience nourishment. I understand there will be soup at this performance.
Yes, that is customary at these presentations, that afterwards we have some kind of delicious homemade soup, and it's shared with audience and artists in a rather informal kind of feedback session.
Well, give folks more information, where they can get more information.
Sure. Yeah, you can find out everything you need to at nacl.org. You can make a reservation there. And the show is at 7:30 on Saturday, August 9th.
At Highland Lake, NACL in Highland Lake. Rima, what's next after A Fishing Line Sings? Are you doing some other work, or are you kind of focusing on this work?
Yes. Well, the other thing that is going on for me is I've been writing my, composing my first chamber opera.
You know, as one does in their spare time.
And that, I've been working on that for quite a long time too. That's entitled Precipice. And it actually, after 7 years of working on it, it's going to have its premiere in January as part of the Prototype Festival. It's like a festival of new opera, at La Mama Theater.
Wow. Amazing. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
We'll have you back. Rima Fand is the creator of A Fishing Line Sings in collaboration with puppet designer Aaron Orr. It's at NACL Theater in Highland Lake Saturday. And there's more information at nacl.org. And thank you to NACL's Brett Kaiser as well. Thank you both.
Tim.
Thank you so much.
I think that's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Dog Mountain Lodge, providing dog boarding and grooming. Also boarding cats, birds, and other exotic pets. Located in Coshecton, New York, and on the web at dogmountainlodge.com. And from North American Cultural Laboratory, Highland Lake, New York, an experimental workspace for performing artists and inquisitive audiences, creating a space for community celebration throughout the year, nacl.org. And from listeners like you.
Hi, I'm Kimberly Izar. Listener support is what keeps Radio Catskill running. It's your donations that keep us on the air and fund the staff and programming that bring local news, culture, and NPR to the Catskills, Northeast Pennsylvania, and beyond. But did you know your support also helps all of our news partners? Here's Philip Antuso from the Times Union Hudson Valley.
I've been coming on Local Edition for years now, and it's a way to get Hudson Valley stories and state stories out to a Catskill listening audience. And that obviously redounds to our benefit. And, you know, you guys have provided reporting that we've shared. The relationship that the Times Union has with Radio Catskill has just made me more aware of what's going on and brought more things onto my radar.
And here's Liam Mayo from The River Reporter.
It's incredibly helpful to be able to find a wider audience for our reporting. It's incredibly helpful to be able to talk about these stories over the air in ways that we don't, you know, get to in the printed versions of the newspaper. But it's also just really important, I think, to have colleagues in the community. Like, any one organization can only cover so much. And having Radio Catskill healthy, having Radio Catskill, like, fully supported by the community is really more important now than ever.
Your donation powers the news, music, and community voices you count on every day. Help keep Radio Catskill strong. Donate now at wjffradio.org. That's wjffradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's forecast, an air quality alert remains in effect. Some smoke could reduce visibility. Cloudy today with a high around 75. A stray shower or thunderstorm possible tonight, low 58. And partly cloudy tomorrow, a high 76. On Point is next. It's 11 o'clock.
WJFF Jeffersonville. This is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.